This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In New York next week, we will revisit some of the critical issues of political protest. Hundreds of thousands of people are expected to participate in a wide range of actions, massive rallies and marches, street theater, civil disobedience. Some friction with police is likely, and some may actually be planned. So what's the best way to get a message of protest across? What's the intended audience? What kind of tactics are appropriate? How important is the way it plays on television? What's the end goal? We'll talk with Todd Gitlin, who organized demonstrations during the Vietnam War and wrote a history of protests of the 1960s, and we'll hear about a couple of different kinds of protests next week. And of course, we want to hear from you. If you've organized demonstrations, call and tell us how you decided on tactics. Did your demonstration work out? In hindsight, would you have changed anything? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, we'll talk with James Bennett, who's just finished up a 3-year assignment as the Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. But first, we go to New York and NPR's Margo Adler, who will be covering protests next week in New York City. Margo, always good to have you on the program.
It's always good to be with you.
Now, one of the big issues leading up to the protest has been
The large march.
The large march.
United
this is
for
Sunday.
Peace and Justice.
Sunday's yes. March. Some wanted it in Central Park. A permit's been issued for what, the West Side Highway?
Well, no, here's what's happened. They lost the case for the park. The judge, Jacqueline Silberman, basically said that they were too late, that they were guilty of inexcusable and inequitable delay. But today, at a news conference, which was incredibly mellow, they had worked out a last-minute deal with the police, and here's what they're going to do. They're going to march past Madison Square Garden. They're going to march, you know, then they're going to go down Fifth Avenue. They're going to go to Union Square, the traditional site of meetings. They're not going to have a rally. And then they're going to disperse. And here's Leslie Kagan, who is the national coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, when she was sort of asked, well, are people going to still go after the march is over to Central Park? Just one second.
Yep.
Here we go.
It's not a big secret in New York. Everybody knows some people are going to go to Central Park. We urge the city to let that happen, to use restraint, and to let both New Yorkers and people visiting our city go to the park. Again, we encourage people to come on our march, to do the whole route of the march with us, and then if they choose to go to Central Park, that's great.
And here she goes. Listen to this.
Do I? Yeah, actually, I will be going to Central Park.
And she said she was going to take a picnic lunch with her. So I think what's going to happen is that a lot of people are going to go to the park sort of as individuals, not as as mass groups. And I think that the city's probably going to let them unless there was some huge rally or it got disruptive. So I think that's what's going to end up happening.
Well, a couple of 100,000 of individuals can look like an organized
Yeah, but I guess if they're in different parts of the park and they're not all in the same place and they're not having a rally, well, we'll see what happens.
Now, this is just one, and this, I guess, is Sunday, right?
That's right. That's right. And it's one of, there must be hundreds of counter-convention activities. And they range from, you know, very serious. You know, there's a Poor People's Bushville Tent City in Brooklyn. There are readings and lamentations for all of the dead, 900 and something, whatever the number of American soldiers dead, coffins parading through the streets. And then there are, of course, incredibly funny, weird events. For example, Al Franken has actually called for people at the moment that President Bush gives his acceptance, you know, a speech for the nomination on Thursday night, to open their windows and call out, "Forget about it," sort of in the tradition of Network, the movie. And then probably the best thing was Paula Revere's ride, which was called by a group, that's already happened, which was called by a group of people who have called themselves Green Dragon, in the honor, I guess, of the tavern where the Boston Tea Party was planned. They ended up doing a demonstration on Tuesday in which they were dressed in what I can only describe as sort of Liberace revolutionary garb. It was kind of spangled red, white, and blue with tri-cornered hats, and they had bells and whistles, and they had these bicycles with horses' heads that were made, you know, made out of papier-mâché and cardboard, and they went riding down Lexington Avenue for Lexington and Concord, shouting, "The Republicans are coming! The Republicans are coming!" And so that was one thing. Today, there was, I just saw on the news, that 12 people were arrested from ACT UP, the AIDS group, the sort of radical AIDS activist group, running naked through the streets past the convention. So, you know, your guess is as good as mine. There are thousands of events planned, and no one really knows what's going to happen.
Well, Mayor Bloomberg says the police are going to be ready no matter what happens. So what kind of plans are they making?
Well, they have been training. They've had, you know, fake protesters that, you know, they have a mobile command center. They have various scenarios, had a breakup, you know, the kind of things that took place in, for example, Seattle, where they have, you know, long lines of people, you know, chained to each other. And so they have tools to break those up, you know. But I think the mayor was very, very upbeat yesterday, saying he thought that everything was going to go without a hitch. And, you know, your guess is as good as mine.
Well, last month when the Democrats held their convention in Boston, there were also anticipation of some pretty big demonstrations. In the end, not all that many people showed up. And the ones that did were to a large measure confined to a sort of official protest area. Is it possible the same kind of thing will happen in New York?
I think there will be many more people, and I do not think they will be confined because there's so many more activities. For example, there are 1,400 people from the convention that are going to Broadway plays Sunday night. And already, all kinds of groups, including a group called Billionaire for Bush, which I gather you're going to have on the show later, are planning, you know, theater in the street. So I don't think it's going to be nearly as contained as it was in Boston.
NPR's Margot Adler speaking with us from our bureau in New York. Good luck next week, Margot.
Need it.
Joining us now on the phone from upstate New York is Todd Gitlin. He was a leader of the 1960s group SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, helped organize protests during the turbulent Democratic National Convention in 1968 in Chicago. Todd Gitlin wrote about his experiences and those of many others in the book The 60s, Years of Hope, Days of Rage. And thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. I didn't, by the way, organize the events in 68, but I was there.
Okay, then I'll take that correction. But Days of Rage does speak to events that did happen in Chicago in 1968 with SDS.
Well, 1968 was a great upheaval, a rally of what turned out to be a few thousand people who were offended by the war in Vietnam and by much else that was happening, including the suppression of the black movement and the recent assassination of Martin Luther King. And the police wanted a riot, and there were some people on the streets who wanted a riot, and together they couldn't be stopped from having a riot.
Is the level of anger that you see today against President Bush equivalent to the level of anger that some of those people had those years ago against the president then of the Democratic president, Johnson? Of course, he was leaving office, and Hubert Humphrey would be nominated that year.
Some of it is. The setting is different. The 68 came after 8 years of pretty much nonstop and accelerating protest around civil rights and the war and many other things, and there was, moreover, a youth rebellion and a general alarm and frolic as well about the in which you know, which could be, you know, which could have gone anywhere and went many places at once. It was many millions of people involved in all kinds of things. So we don't have that sort of general scatter of feeling and passion today. But we do have certainly a lot of rancor.
And tell us a little bit about how that played out in Chicago, what was described by the commission that looked into it as a police riot. A lot of people who were there thought, we're the victims. This is going to play in our favor.
Yeah, the demonstrations were actually much smaller than anybody had anticipated. In the run-up, many people decided not even to go to Chicago, including to do some of the sort of playful things that Margot Aguilar was just talking about.
Abby Hoffman was alive and well in those days.
Yeah, and so a lot of people didn't show up in the first place. So the percentage of people who did show up who had mayhem on their minds was pretty large, and they were also agents provocateurs, people working for military intelligence, the FBI, the Chicago police, who wanted things to get out of hand and did help them get out of hand by doing things like pulling down flags off flagpoles and that sort of thing. In the streets, things were so grotesque, so militarized, so gas-choked, that it seemed miraculous that one could get through the week, you know, with one's skin on. And so many people, including me, felt at the end of the week, well, we must have won, you know. Thus the chant, the whole world is watching. The very fact that the cameras were there and relaying the mayhem of the streets to the wider world was somehow the proof, or was anticipated to be the proof, that we had won and that the bad guys were discredited. Lo and behold, that's not what the polls showed. 60% of people who saw these events on television thought the police were right and the demonstrators were wrong.
Our guest is Todd Gitlin. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. And let's talk with Carl, who's on the line in Grand Haven, Michigan.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm wondering what would prevent a little reverse psychology here. That's to say, Republican people who are fomenting problems or trouble just to drive the moderate or undecided voters into the arms of the other camp.
In other words, agent provocateur in New York as well as there were in Chicago in 1968.
Well, it would have the opposite effect of the intended protest, you know, by driving moderates away from maybe a moderate cause and into the right at the convention. I just wonder, and I hadn't heard much about that, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Carl, thanks.
Thank you.
The answer is nothing's to prevent that from happening.
If there is violence, whoever starts it, do you think that's going to be the effect?
It'll be very hard to know who does start it. I do think that violence plays into the hands of the Republican Party. They've already announced that they're planning to smear the Democrats if there's any trouble. We've seen in the last couple of weeks how adept people in the Republican orbit are to exploit whatever's lying around in order to cloak themselves with the mantle of necessity and reliability. And your guess is good as mine as to what they're actually planning to do.
We've had, a lot of demonstrations between Chicago 68 and New York City next week. Have tactics changed? Are demonstrations different today?
Tactics are always changing. You mentioned Abby Hoffman before. Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin and the rest of the Yippies wanted to put on what they called a festival of life in the streets of Chicago. In the end, it pretty much dribbled down to running around with a greased pig, and which they claimed to be running for president, Pegasus, and various kinds of frolics and playful things. Probably it'll be on a much larger scale this time. But, you know, people are always restless. Protesters are like anybody else, like political tacticians of all kinds. And they're always conjuring new styles and new formats because they're in the attention-getting business, just as politicians are and just as the media are. And they're always mindful of what it is that's going to carry their message and their symbolism outward. It's a big symbolic theatrical display.
And, theatrics is a big element. I'll hold this for when we come back from a break, because 30 seconds is not enough time to answer it. But how important is it, how well it plays out on television? We'll ask Todd Gitlin that question when we do come back from a break. If you'd like to join our conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email address is TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation. We'll be back after a short break. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As delegates and protesters begin to arrive in New York for the Republican National Convention, we're talking about tactics of demonstrations and how much protest rallies actually accomplished. And we're speaking right now with Todd Gitlin. He's the author of The 60s, Years of Hope, Days of Rage, a professor of culture, journalism, and sociology at New York University. And Todd Gitlin, before the break, I was posing the question, how important is it how something, whatever it is, plays out on television?
Actually, no longer at NYU. I'm at Columbia University.
I apologize.
How long is it? How important is television? Massively. Because the event really exists in the minds of those who behold it. And if it's a political event, the reverberations are in the consequence. So therefore, impressions are everything. And that's why many people who are organizing demonstrations are putting on a, are aware that they're putting on a show and they're mindful of an audience. And then there are other people who are in an expressive mood, an exhibitionist mood, if you will, who affect themselves at least rather indifferent to how the audience is going to be seeing it. And sometimes they sometimes they're actually being disingenuous because they're also thinking about how the event is going to appear, and how they want it to appear is disturbing, troubling, and in your face.
Joining us now by phone from Newark, New Jersey, is Jason Flores Williams. He's planning on protesting next week during the Republican National Convention in New York City. Thanks very much for being with us.
I appreciate it.
What kind of protest are you planning to attend?
Well, I'm going to start tomorrow night with a critical mass bike ride through New York. That should be a good kickoff fun. Then on Sunday, I'm leading a contingent from Rutgers Law here down to the UFPJ rally. We're going to start at Union Square around 9 o'clock in the morning, have our coffee and bagel, and then engage in the expression and realization of the First Amendment, and then take that on into Central Park.
Who is the audience to whom you are trying to communicate?
Well, this is the interesting question, isn't it? With whom is a protest movement in dialogue with? First, I don't think I'm certainly not in dialogue with this supposed swing state voter watching television, because I don't think he's getting his clues to who to vote for from me. I'm not that arrogant. I think that a protest movement is in dialogue, first and foremost, with itself. We have worked hard so that we can put some teeth into the First Amendment and express through personal catharsis and through our voices and our bodies our dissatisfaction with this administration.
What kind of tactics do you think are appropriate?
I'm not going to condone violence. I'm not going to disavow violence either. I think that the tactics, the Jeffersonian tactics, let's put it that way, I think that Thomas Jefferson had an idea about dissent, and that part of that is no business as usual. The fabric of society must be stepped on a little bit during the time of the protest, and to bring to people's minds that the policies of the administration are so unacceptable that normal life cannot simply just go on. So however that's achieved, then it's achieved.
What about the consequence of your whatever actions may take part, whether you're part of them or not, violence might play into the hands of, as some people say, the people you're protesting against, the Republicans?
Well, that's saying that if something happens in the protest and Karl Rove takes it and runs on a law and order platform, just like Chicago 68. First off, that's an assumption that has never been proved. Everything political is quantified, and Chicago 68. There's never been anything showing that had any real influence on the election. McGovern, he won one state.
Wrong election.
Yes, it was not McGovern that year. It was Humphrey, and he lost by a whisker.
Oh, well, I stand corrected. Nonetheless, there's nothing ever been shown quantifiably that protest has influenced elections. So I'm not going to engage in protest with thinking about the consequences of how it's going to affect the national election. And secondly, the idea that, you know, John Kerry, another Skull and Bones member, is the total solution for the problems that stand in America today, I think is kind of ridiculous.
Well, Jason Flores Williams, thanks very much for being with us, and good luck next week.
I appreciate it.
Jason Flores Williams, a political activist who, as we heard, will be in New York starting this weekend to protest the Republican National Convention, and he was on the line with us from Newark, New Jersey. Todd Gitlin, first of all, Do you believe that protests played no part in the 1968 elections?
No. I think everything played a part in the 1968 election because it was so close that a turnaround of 334,000 votes in three big anti-war states would have deprived Nixon of an electoral majority. I think that's reckless and foolhardy to claim that. It's also ignorant, as we just heard. He didn't even know who was running against Nixon. The notion that demonstrators are in communication with itself, with themselves, that they are doing nothing but catharsis is absolutely staggering. As soon as you're on television, you're no longer in communication with yourself. You may desire to have the masturbatory stance, but the world has something else intended for you, and you're not living on another planet.
And you
would be wanting to be communicating with swing state voters, but they're paying attention to you.
There are others who say, look, we're not trying to communicate so much with people in this country. We're trying to express our solidarity with people overseas who are suffering, and we want to show them that the American people are opposed to the foreign policy of the Bush administration.
Well, that's very well. If you want to pick up a telephone and make a long-distance call to another country, you have a First Amendment right to do that. I don't think you can make a case that it has the slightest positive impact on American policy, which is, after all, the issue. And those abroad, I think, might appreciate an endeavor which helps them fend off the worst depredations of American foreign policy. And the proof of whether that is possible takes place on Election Day.
Let's get a caller on the line. Carrie is with us from Oracle, Arizona.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. My question for your guest, how does he feel about the apathy, the general apathy of the nation as it is today? Because 12 years.
Carrie, your cell phone is betraying you, but I think we got the gist of the question. Todd Gitlin, did you get a chance to hear that?
I didn't even get the gist, Neil.
He said, how do you feel about what he said was apathy today, people are not generally mobilized?
Well, in fact, there are very impressive signs that people are coming to political life in all kinds of activity this year, and I'm hopeful that we'll see a juicing up of Democratic involvement. We certainly are seeing lots of people planning to register voters and go to swing states and contribute money and organize actions and attend rallies and turn out voters who are already registered and so on. All that is auspicious.
Mm-hmm. As you looked at the history of the protest movements of the 60s, I think it's undeniable that the civil rights demonstrations, the massive marches on Washington and other places, they certainly had an impact on what happened.
Absolutely. Well, they had an impact because, in part because they were morally unexceptionable and except by racists, and they were and they rallied a majority opinion, but also crucially because in that setting they had political authorities in Washington who could be budged. And that's why anyone, I think, who seriously wants to protest the policies of this administration should be focusing laser-like on putting in office a Democratic president who can be swayed, because the current administration patently cannot be.
As demonstrations against the Vietnam War continued during the Johnson and then the Nixon administrations, people became very frustrated when even enormous demonstrations seemingly had no effect.
Seemingly is right. In fact, they were having an effect, but of course, first President Johnson and then President Nixon were lying about the effect. But this generates one of the awful paradoxes coming out of the 60s, namely that as the war became less popular, the war in Vietnam, that is, so did the anti-war movement. And this was enormously consequential because it left the anti-war movement and the left in general strung out at the edge of a cliff, being despised as much as or more than the war they were protesting.
Let's get a caller on the line. Harriet's with us from Gary, Indiana.
You know, I was wondering if I was going to have to form a protest since I hadn't heard from a female caller. Look, I have have to disagree with your guest as well as the caller before this last one that we couldn't hear clearly. There are people such as myself who participate in a protest either by direct frontline organization or becoming a member simply because we are passionate about that viewpoint. We want our thoughts and ideas conveyed publicly. And yes, we hopefully also want to entice others or at least educate at a very minimal others what the subject matter is. Case in point, I marched annually in a quiet protest in Washington, D.C. around the weekend of the anniversary of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King for the purpose of getting his birthday anniversary as a national holiday. That concluded with having workshops on how to educate and get this bill passed. It eventually was done. Not exactly as we wanted it, but the bottom line was it's done. The second one that comes to mind is that I was a frontline organizer when I lived in D.C. with advisory neighborhood commissioners. And for your national audience outside of Minnesota, that's an elected position somewhere between a precinct committeeman and a council member.
Mm-hmm.
We organized the ANC commissioners to demonstrate at the South African embassy to express our displeasure and disdain for apartheid and to free those political prisoners. Consequently, not only was Nelson Mandela freed, but others were. We were not demonstrating to play to the TV cameras for the sake of it. We were doing this in both cases because we believed in the cause. And the first one, the annual one for Dr. King's birthday becoming a national holiday, it was energizing to work and labor in your respective community for another year and know that you were coming together in a year again if the holiday had not been passed as national legislation. I think your guest is making it too academic. It's nice to sit and come up with all the theories and hypotheses regarding those of us who protest. I have never participated in a violent protest and certainly would not.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few years ago when I lived in D.C. again. The Klan had gotten a permit to march from Pennsylvania Avenue at the Capitol to the White House or somewhere along there. I did, in fact, expect that to be a violent protest, and I did participate. Blessed assurance, they were bussed in a metro public city bus, and they did not walk down the street, even though we did see one on the bus in full white regalia.
Yeah. Harriet, let me get a response from Todd Gitlin.
Well, as somebody who began participating in demonstrations against apartheid in South Africa in 1965, I certainly laud the caller. But I would still maintain that such movements reverberate and work best when they can command larger public attention. And there's no contradiction at all between the passion that the demonstrators feel and the ability to command the national spotlight. You need the national spotlight in order to get big results.
Todd Gitlin, thanks very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
Todd Gitlin, the author of The 60s, Years of Hope, Days of Rage, now a professor at Columbia University in New York. He joined us on the line from upstate New York. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Over 30 groups are planning to take some kind of action in New York this weekend and next week. One of them, as we heard earlier in the program, Billionaires for Bush. A member of the group, Alyssa Gigi, joins us now from New York. Good to have you on the program.
Good afternoon, Neil.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the activities you have planned this weekend?
Well, certainly we've got a fabulous lineup of events for the Republican National Convention, starting with our croquet game in Central Park. And I'll give you a little scoop, if you like.
Go ahead.
The real reason that 500,000 peaceful protesters are being barred from Central Park is so that the billionaires can honor a previously arranged game of croquet.
Now, I understand that as you don your guise of a billionaire for Bush, you take on a certain character.
Well, yes, I'm known around here at Billionaires for Bush HQ as Mega Bucks.
And similar names are monikers, if you will, are awarded to others of your membership.
Oh, yes, indeed. Our schmoozer-in-chief, of course, is Mr. Phil T. Rich. And I believe that your producer arranged this interview with Lucinda Regulations, one of our crack PR team.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, satire is important in the expression of your views. How effective is that getting a message across?
Well, if I can talk in all seriousness and take my tiara off for a second, we find that humor is a way that people really respond to our messaging. And we've gone from 2 chapters to 75 in the last 5 or 6 months. And this is from people who have read about us in the paper or seen our website, going to our do-it-yourself kit, which has got all of our placards and slogans and song lyrics and logos. They download all of that stuff. They get themselves some tuxedos, tiaras, and ball gowns, and they go out and do billionaire actions in their hometown. Sometimes they don't even let us know about it until after they're done. So it's really this viral grassroots movement that's taking place across the country. And the response has been really positive because people, I mean, who doesn't love a tiara, for one thing? And people respond to humor. Humor is funny and people like it. So it's a very good way to open the conversation.
Well, let's get another caller on the line. Kathleen is with us from Athens, Ohio.
Yeah, hi. I've attended most of the marches in Washington and New York against the war in Iraq. And then prior to that, I had been to marches against Vietnam. And I was really, truly impressed by groups such as the Bread and Puppet Theater. I think they're out of Vermont. When the women or men were dressed up as Iraqi women falling to the ground in fear and depression when the American bombs began to fall. But what I was really alarmed with at these marches was the lack of accurate coverage on just how incredibly diverse these marches have been. And I just wonder why people have to go to such levels of antics. I would like to see the media, and I challenge people to contact national media sources to interview people that are pushing their babies there in strollers and the seniors who are there in wheelchairs and the blue-collar workers and the Vietnam and World War II and Korean vets. I mean, show the world who is really at these marches. Don't be afraid to show the rest of the gray hairs who's really there. I interviewed probably close to 700 people at these marches, and I'm talking, we're talking to middle America at these marches. So I wish the media...
And I hate to cut you off, Kathleen, but I wanted to give Alyssa Gigi a chance to respond to your point.
Well, of course, the billionaires, my dear, own the media. So that might be part of the reason why you're not seeing yourself adequately represented. But we are staging our very own march. We're welcoming home our Get on the Limo tour. We sent a limo through 8 of the battleground states, and they're arriving back to a hero's welcome in New York City on Sunday the 29th, and we will be marching in a million billionaire march.
Well, Kathleen, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate
it. Okay, thank you.
And Alyssa Gigi, or Meg A. Bucks, we want to thank you for your time today as well.
Oh, you're very welcome. And I encourage people to come to our website, billionairesforbush.com, if they'd like to join us for our antics and our RNC.
When we come back from a short break, we'll talk with James Bennett about his 3 years as Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.